Ken, how do you stay relevant that second term?
I think you do. You govern as if it was your first day in office, not your last day in office. Yes, we had the bump, the major hurdle of Iran-Contra. But before that, we also had tax reform with Marty Russo. And one of the most fundamental tax bills in American history, at least modern, and it took place in the second term. So did immigration reform. So did welfare reform. Social Security reform.
Really, yeah.
All were the first two and a half years of the second term. But after Iran-Contra, and when the president fired Don Regan, he did it in part because he realized that the White House and he needed new blood and fresh ideas. And the credibility of Frank Carlucci and Colin Powell and Howard Baker and myself, not just as managers, but somebody who could figure out a strategy to make those last 2 years important. When I came back to the White House, what people were writing about was that Ronald Reagan wasn't a lame duck, he was a dead duck. Why? Because he had just lost the United States Senate to the Democrats for the last 2 years of his term. Reagan went out of his way to rebuild the presidency so that we did the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. In hindsight, it looks easy, except Jim Baker, my wonderful predecessor and then Secretary of the Treasury, couldn't push it over the line. It took the president to do it. The president had built up a trusting relationship with the Congress on both sides of the aisle, so he was able to recreate a coalition. He did the strategic arms negotiation with Gorbachev, the two summit meetings, and the treaty. We got a Supreme Court nominee, Anthony Kennedy, from here in Northern California, approved overwhelmingly by a Democratic Senate. And I know this is going to sound weird, but we had all 13 appropriation bills passed on time. Not bad for a B-movie actor in the last 2 years of his term.
Erskine, you were there.
We balanced the budget.
There you go.
That's true. Yeah.
And to get that done, I had to spend months and months and months locked up in conference rooms with Newt Gingrich, and y'all owe me a lot for that, I'm telling you. But President Clinton loved being president. I mean, he loved it. He, you know, he delighted in it. He wanted to use every day to make this country a better place to live and work and raise your family. I mean, what? Give you an example of something that, you know, shows his humanity. You know, literally almost every day he'd come over from the East Wing to the West Wing, and he'd have articles that had been in various newspapers from around the country, little teeny papers, you know, that he'd ripped out, and it'd been somebody who'd gotten some kind of bad deal, and he'd give those articles to me, and he said, "Erskine, go fix this." You know, and but that person would never know that the president of this country cared enough about their problem to try to make it better. And that's what he did. And I think he had a successful second term, you know, in spite of the fact that we were going through, you know, people say it's so partisan now. It felt a little partisan then. They were impeaching him, you know. But we were able to work with a Republican House and Senate because the president really knew what he wanted to accomplish in that second term. And I think the proudest I ever saw him, Leon, was not the day that we balanced the budget, but how we balanced the budget. And I'll never forget coming in and telling him, "Mr. President, we've got a deal, and in that deal, we got health care insurance for 5 million poor kids." And it's the happiest I ever saw him during my tenure.
Let me ask this before we're going to go to questions from the audience, but before I get there, let me just ask this question. We all know that the presidency is a very isolating job. You got presidents get elected, they suddenly go to the White House, Secret Service is all around them, they can't go anyplace, they can't walk like Truman used to walk around the place. They're basically, in some ways, trapped in the office itself. And as a result, you know, it's really tough not only to try to stay in touch, but to protect your humanity. Just give me the shortest answer you can with regards to how did your president protect the human side of that individual in a situation where there is all this isolation and this these pressures of the job?
You'll get a kick out of the fact that Ronald Reagan loved to call congressmen and senators, but not in Washington. But the White House switchboard would connect the congressman or senator back in his district. And so everybody understands in Washington, oh, the White House is on the phone. But you call in a district, as you guys know, and Marty, it's a big deal. And Reagan would insist upon talking to the receptionist first. What's going on in your town? What's happening? I know it's President Reagan, but tell me. And you get the congressman on the phone. What do you hear in your town hall meeting? What do you hear when you're walking the streets or going to a rally? What do I need to know? All of a sudden, there was chatter all over. The President of the United States called Congressman Panetta, Congressman Russo. You know, what did you tell him? You told him you're going to support him, didn't you? And that's how you start getting the consensus in America to impact the congressman in the hometown. And that's also how we kept Reagan grounded, not from his California kitchen cabinet, but much more from the rank and file. And where's Ted?
Ted Balistrieri.
And I used to go home to my original birthplace, Brooklyn, New York, near Ted's house. And I used to sit at a luncheon counter. And people knew me when I was 18 years old. What are you hearing? What's going on? What do I need to know back in Washington? And I was sitting there in a pair of jeans and a baseball cap. People will open up to you. And then I would share it with the president.
Yeah. Erskine?
Well, I think I just gave one good example. But we did everything we possibly could to keep the president in touch with everyday folks. We never had a problem with him wanting to hear people from different walks of life. I mean, he wanted your opinion. He wanted it bark on, bark off. He wanted to know what you really felt. But as I think Ken said a few minutes ago, when any of you all walk into the Oval Office, you might have spent 20 minutes with Leon and me first, and we might say, look, when you go in there, you tell him exactly what you told us, okay? And then you walk in that Oval Office, and the president says,
how am I doing?
Yeah, right.
Oh, just great, Mr. President. You're the best. You're the greatest.
So it's
you
hard.
Got that right.
We tried everything. We tried pulling people off a rope line, who were going through the White House to come meet the president.
That worked out well for you, didn't it?
Yeah, really good. Yeah.
That was one of my best ideas.
All right, well, let's move on. Andy?
I tried to make sure the president always had time with his wife and time to pay attention to his daughters. No scheduler scheduled time for the president to spend quality time with his daughters or his wife. They didn't schedule time for him to talk to a friend, or to see a movie, or even read a book. So I tried to make sure the president had time to see friends that were not part of the political community, Yes, he had friends in Congress, and yes, that was a little bit like work, but I really wanted him to have time to talk to people that weren't carrying the burdens of the office, but were carrying the concerns of the nation. Mm-hmm. And we tried to do that. He enjoyed going away to Camp David. He greatly enjoyed going to Crawford, to his ranch. But he really liked being with friends that were not there using him so that he could befriend them. And that is a hard thing to schedule because time is short, the decisions are important, and the policy concerns are great. But I really tried to focus on allowing the president to interact with people that had concerns that were not nationally driven concerns. Instead, they were personally driven interests in a great country.
Well, first of all, I mentioned the family, very, very important to him, kept him very much grounded. In the same vein, his friends, his old friends were his friends, and he got together. Some friends he grew up with would come periodically. He was very close. But in terms of keeping in touch with the country, one of the first things the president did was said, I want 10 letters a night that are representative of the letters that we're getting. And he would, sometimes he would write handwritten notes back, other times he would call, but he would respond to all these letters. More importantly, he would circulate these letters around the White House, and he would, and if we were in a discussion on the economic crisis, and he was told that small business lending was moving forward apace, and he had had four letters from people who couldn't get any credit, you know, and he would have those checked out, and he would come back with these stories. So these letters became very important to him, and also very difficult for him because they were heartbreaking. Some of them were just really heartbreaking about people struggling out there, and he would cite them often. And in private conversations, he'd talk to me about them. Finally, you know, I think traveling and actually interacting with people is really, really important. I went in the summer of 2009 with a poll to say, you know, we're taking on some water on this healthcare thing. And this was not news to him, by the way. He said, I know you're right, but I just got back from Green Bay, Wisconsin. I met a woman, 36 years old, married, had two children, a job, insurance, but she also has stage 4 breast cancer, and now she's hit her lifetime cap, and she's worried about dying and leaving her family bankrupt. And by now, I feel him. He had his hand in the small of my back, kind of easing me out of his office. But on the way out the door, he said, so let's just keep fighting. This is the country we believe in, you know. So, I mean, I think that human interaction is very important.
No, it is. Absolutely. Let me take a quick break here to recognize our question review team, who are the people that are responsible for selecting the questions that I'll present to our speakers. And I'd ask you to hold your applause until I introduce the entire group. They are Julie Copeland, who's the city editor with the Santa Cruz Sentinel, Mary Duan, editor from the Monterey County Weekly, Doug McKnight, who's a reporter from KAZU Radio, Don Miller, executive editor of the Monterey Herald and the Santa Cruz Sentinel, and Jeff Mitchell, who's the senior writer and political columnist for the Salinas Californian. If you'd all thank them, please. There was some comment about some of the students in the audience. They are military, and we have, you know, we were able to host them in terms of talking about some of the issues that we talked about. Let me introduce. First of all, let me have them all stand, if I could. Let me personally thank you for your service to this country. We deeply appreciate it. They are students from the Defense Language Institute and the Navy Postgraduate School. Thank you, and you may be seated. And lastly, if I could mention that throughout our lecture series, obviously the student participation in these events is possible only because of the generous support of our lecture series sponsors. And so Sylvia and I along with the Panetta Institute Board of Directors, are very grateful for the sponsorship. We get students from high schools, colleges, universities, military institutions throughout Northern California to be able to participate and to be able to learn about the political issues facing this country. So I would appreciate it if you give our sponsors a hand as well. Let me turn to some of the questions here from our audience, if I could. Let's talk about one of the more recent conflicts we've just seen in Washington with Secretary Shinseki and the Veterans Administration. Secretary Shinseki and the Veterans Administration, obviously there was a scandal at the Veterans Administration. It seemed to take weeks for the president and the secretary to act. Shouldn't he have been fired earlier? David?
Why me? I didn't know. You see, I didn't applaud for the panel that screened the questions because I want to hear the questions first. You know, the God's honest truth is, if you're talking about pure politics, probably would have made sense, because there's nothing that Washington loves or demands more than a body to be thrown out whenever there's a problem. Now, the fact is that General Shinseki had done many things well. He had administered the post 9/11 GI Bill, and taken 2 million more veterans, new policies related to Agent Orange and PTSD. And, you know, so he'd done a lot of things well. And you know, it is the president's habit and practice not to throw bodies out just because of there's bloodlust in Washington. So as a matter of pure politics, yeah, I mean, the play would have been to fire someone quickly. But the decent and honorable thing was to really look at the facts and see what was known, what wasn't known, what was done, and what wasn't done. And that's what he did.
Go ahead, Ken.
I think the tipping point came, though, and I agree with what David said, but the tipping point came not when so many Republicans came out for the resignation of Shinseki, but when the Democrats in very contested Senate seats and vulnerable House Democrats started lining up to impose Shinseki. Yeah. That is the tipping scale that wound up with.
I didn't say bloodlust was a partisan pursuit. All of Washington engages in it.
But that was the tipping point.
Let me ask you this. Did Reagan like to fire people?
Hated it. Because it showed loyalty to his cabinet, loyalty to some White House staff. But when confronted with it, eventually, it was the job of the chief of staff to say, time to go. And whether that was Ollie North or John Poindexter, Reagan, he did have to fire. As well as occasional a cabinet officer. But he held out in a sense of loyalty and importance of making sure that they could make right before he let them go.
Erskine? Bill Clinton?
Well, you know, I learned something about politics from Al Simpson. I know Al's been out here. I love Al. Al described politics to me. He said it comes from the Greek word poly, meaning many, and tix, meaning blood-sucking insects. My experience is that most politicians got to where they are by saying yes and not by saying no. And so I always felt it was my responsibility that if something like this had to be done, that I would take care of it, that I would be the guy that said no, or I would be the guy to let somebody go. And that's the way we did it. But that also means that you also have a responsibility when you're dealing with the president himself, and it's just the two of you in the room. Right. You can't be afraid of losing your job. You've got to stand up and say, Mr. President, I don't think this is the right way for us to go.
Andy?
Presidents really don't like to fire anybody. Sometimes they have to, and they come to recognize it. I think General Shinseki, first of all, he's a patriot and did a great job in service to our country. And he did an awful lot at Veterans Administration, did an outstanding job for much of what he did. However, he ended up personifying the problem. And once you start personifying the problem, Congress doesn't see the solution. And so I think that it was the right thing for Secretary Shinseki to tender his resignation. And I don't know whether President Obama asked for it or not, but I'm going to say that he tendered his resignation. And since all of us who have served, served at the pleasure of the president for the time being. That's what our little document says that hangs on our wall, and it's redundant in its insecurity. And I think Secretary Shinseki's time being arrived. And I don't know if the pleasure was gone, but the time being arrived, I think it was appropriate for him to leave. But no president likes to say goodbye to a staffer. And I've watched presidents hold on to people they shouldn't have held on to very long, but they did, and others who agonized over the goodbye longer than they should have.
Yeah. I would only add that even though Erskine is an aberration at his height, every chief of staff started out to be Erskine's height, and we're all now 5'9".
We talked about two terms for the president. Here's a question. Should the president's term be changed to a single six-year term? Andy?
I don't think it should be, because then it would make the president a lame duck on year one of a six-year term. And Congress would not pay as much attention as they should. We watched the president's authority wane as his political support wanes, and people would already start to be looking at who the next president would be, which we'll talk about before we end up leaving. But no, I do not support a six-year term. I think it's important for the president to be conscious of the pulse of America the same way members of Congress have to be conscious of it. They just have to be paranoid about it. Presidents shouldn't be paranoid.
Yeah, I mean, there was actually a column about this recently. And I thought about it because there is some, I mean, you know, basically you spend the last year of your first term running for re-election, and then you run into the problems that we've talked to in your second term. But I actually thought that it was an important exercise for the president to go back to the country and run for re-election. And I don't think we want to divorce the president from the electorate after that first election.
Oh, I am strongly opposed to a six-year term, for all the reasons that Andy gave and David gave. I just want to take the opportunity, though, to also talk that the challenge, whether it's President Obama or when President Reagan had it, was to try to make sure that he is succeeded by somebody of his own party. Reagan was able to do that with George Herbert Walker Bush, but you have to go back about 50 years before that is true before, for a two-term to be succeeded by somebody of his own party. That is one of the measures also of the importance of a second term that you mentioned before about staying relevant.
Bruce, can you feel any different?
Yeah, I do. I have the complete opposite opinion on that. If I felt that the president's just spent the last year of a four-year term running for re-election, I might feel the same way that David does, but I don't. I feel like, you know, the campaign almost starts the day they're reelected or day they are elected. And therefore, I also think too many presidents make decisions based on, you know, what kind of effect it will have on their reelection as opposed to what they might think is the best for the country. So I'd really like to see 1 6-year term. I think it could really be very positive.
I guess I'm influenced by the fact that we made a bunch of disastrous political decisions that we had to make. So we weren't sitting there making decisions, thinking about re-election. We didn't have that luxury. So
yeah. This is a good question. How does social media, instant reporting, 24-hour news affect the presidential decision process? Does it affect just the public affairs piece or the decision overall?
we are living at a time when, you know, as I mentioned to you earlier, we've moved beyond fireside chats. We've got blogs, we've got, you know, Twitter, we've got Facebook, we've got everything that immediately reports things. How does all of that affect the presidential decision-making process? Erskine, let's start with you.
Well, you know, when we talked about this earlier, I thought Andy had the absolute best answer to that about the lid. Can Andy tell that story first, and
sure.
then we'll go into it?
Sure. When I first went to the White House after a forgettable campaign for governor of Massachusetts in 1982, and I showed up in August of 1983, very excited to be working at the White House with President Reagan, and at around 4:30 in the afternoon, over a loudspeaker system that went throughout the West Wing of the White House and the old executive office building where a lot of White House staffers are, there would be an announcement from the press secretary's office. And it said, the lid is on, the lid is on. That meant news for the day had ended. Reporters were putting stuff into their editorial teams and editors, and the evening news was getting ready to be broadcast, so there was no more news. And it was like everybody in the White House, yeah. And there was also a discipline that you could tell reporters practiced strong ethics because they wouldn't run a story unless they had two sources, and you could find out that they had one source and they were trolling hard for that second confirming source. But they wouldn't run it if they didn't have two confirming sources. Then all of a sudden, cable news came along, and they couldn't run the loop enough over the course of the day and maintain eyeballs and ears, so they had to put alert! And that meant they had to have something new to say every once in a while.
Breaking news. And,
breaking news. And so they made a conscious decision They made a decision to go with one source, not two. And then other cable news outlets came along and radio talk show, and they said, heck, we're just going to go with a good rumor if anybody responds to it. And so all of a sudden the momentum changed, and it was a 24-hour cycle, and the lid was never put on. Now we have opportunities to communicate instantaneously. We can offer a burp, and it shows up in a tweet, and somebody's invited to respond to it, and we respond without thinking, and all of a sudden the response come out in 140 characters. I'm sorry, I said 40 characters before. 140 characters, and the person who puts them out owns the response, and they refuse to move off of it even if they know it was wrong, and so they don't allow good judgment to be used. And so we are communicating instantaneously with our emotions, and Congress is the most paranoid, so they communicate the most with your emotions, and they echo them. And judgment, which is what our republic was founded on, we were founded as a democracy that had representatives represent us, offering some judgment before they made a decision, and then senators took a longer time to consider judgment, and a president could exercise judgment after watching what happened in Congress. Now we're reacting to emotions very quickly, and people get stuck on stupid with the responses that they make, and we don't taste words before we spit them out, and our thumbs are not restrained as we punch, and our hashtag is used before we rehash.
How do you feel about it?
You can see why I want you to go.
We can't put that genie back in the bottle.
You don't have to speak. Yeah.
So our democracy, it looks less like a judgment-informed republic, and it's emotionally driven, and people do get stuck on stupid, and government doesn't work.
I think the worst. Now, there are many bad manifestations of this, and I started off as a newspaper reporter covering politics back in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, and, you know, when we had like 24 hours to report out our story, or generally as much time as we needed, and there wasn't this deadline of pressure every 10 minutes, every 10 seconds, every, you know, with every tweet, every rumor. But the other thing that's happened is because of cable competition and so on, everything gets blown into a humongous story. So You know, every day is election day in Washington. Every story is going to define the presidency. And the thing I always remember, the example I always use, now this wasn't a small thing by any stretch, but when the oil leak happened in the Gulf, this was, and I don't mean to touch on it, but this was, it was called Obama's Katrina. This was going to be the end of his presidency. This was the, do you know that it came, it was dealt with, and I don't think it came up once in the 2012 campaign. And one of the things that, one of the disciplines you have to learn when you are in the White House is to evaluate these rabbits and not chase them all down the hole, and recognize that there really aren't very many defining stories that come along in the course of a presidency, and you shouldn't get in a panic along with the rest of the political community and journalists and pseudo-journalists.
Every year I live there, I came to believe that Hubert Humphrey was really right when he described Washington as 26 square miles surrounded by reality.
Ken, any thoughts?
My problem is because of modern media. When you have the Arab Spring in Cairo, in Tahrir Square, and you have a protester arguing against the United States, and you have a split screen and the White House podium in the press room is responding to a protester in instant time. If you're in the White House, you don't have to think about winning the second or the minute, but you need to win the month, the 6 months, the years. You need a consistent strategy. And you don't know who this protester is. You don't know what he or she is standing for. And to equate that person with the podium of the President of the United States and having the press secretary responding seems to me to be dangerous for governing, especially in America.
But, you know, social media has affected the presidency in another way, right. And you touched on it, which is the Arab Spring started with
social media.
A fruit peddler in Tunisia who lit himself on fire. This went viral. And the whole region went up. And this is another thing that makes the presidency, I think, much more difficult today than it's ever been before.
Talking about the press, I mean, obviously, presidents rely a great deal when they're running in a campaign on the press. And when they suddenly go into the White House, in part, the press turns fickle against that particular president, and the president starts to get a little paranoid about the press. And presidents begin to then, they don't do as many press conferences, they don't go out and deal with the press as much. Tell me the relationship, between the president you served and the press. How did he regard the press? What was the relationship like, Ken?
Ronald Reagan really respected the press. It was an adversarial relationship, but he loved a whole bunch of the press people. First and foremost, believe it or not, was Sam Donaldson, who always gave him the shouted question. And you remember Reagan with his ear cup, "I can't hear you, Sam." The reality, which I said to Sam in a panel like this, was when we didn't want Reagan to answer the question, as he was leaving for Camp David on the helicopter, before we walked outside the dip room, I ordered the pilot of the helicopter to start his engines.
It's true.
Because you never want to make the President of the United States a liar. "I can't hear you." Well, I couldn't hear him. The President encouraged all of us to spend time with the press, because even on an off the record, if we couldn't answer their questions, we better go back and do more homework. The last thing I'll say, one of my fondest vignettes of the press and Reagan was Sam Donaldson, Lou Cannon of the Washington Post, Andrea Mitchell of NBC News were all fighting about who was going to do the last pool report on Air Force One on 26,000 as we headed back to California at the end of the Reagan presidency. And my lasting memory on a portable typewriter was Sam Donaldson on the floor of Air Force One typing the final pool report, and Reagan came back to say thank you. That's the kind of relationship, even though it gets tough. Iran-Contra. My job in the aftermath of Iran-Contra was to remind Reagan before he went within shouting distance of Sam or Andrea or anybody else, remember, if you answer the question on Iran-Contra, you might as well not give the speech you're giving today because nobody's going to cover it. So you're wasting your time if you answer it. And for I used to do this on a daily basis, and he'd be good for about 5-6 weeks. And then Sam would hit something, and bam!
They would take care of it.
And that night, upstairs from the residence, after talking with Nancy, I would get a phone call. Yeah, I really messed up today. I won't do it again. And I knew we were good for another 4 or 5 weeks.
Erskine Clinton in the press.
Oh, you can answer this one. You know, when I was about 12 years old and you were chief of staff, Ken. And Reagan was president, you know. I always fought the press, you know, because they were so liberal, but they didn't like Reagan because he was conservative. And I found out when I became chief of staff that was not true. I think it's very tough. You want to make sure that you always tell the truth, that you keep the press informed. You've got to feed a hungry beast, but they are insatiable. And I found it to be a real challenge. I can tell you that no sin or deed goes unpunished or unpublished in the White House. And you just got to work at it, and you got to always wake up every day and decide you're going to do the right thing, and you're always going to tell the truth. And if you do that, you're going to be all right. But it ain't always pleasant.
We used to brief when the president did a press conference. We used to have a group around the table, and the president would sit there, and we'd fire questions.
And we'd get under
They were going to come from the press. Fire questions at the president. And, of course, you know, they could be very uncomfortable questions, and the president would just, you know, lift up off the floor. And he would, you know, circle around. And I remember Al Gore used to say, "Oh, that's a fine answer, Mr. President. That'll make the news."
Yeah.
And then, you know, the president would settle down and he'd come back and he'd get the right answer in his head. Yeah. And, you know, he'd be good. But it was really almost, you know, a therapy session to try to deal with what the press was going to ask. Andy?
I found the president liked the reporters but didn't like the way they did their job all the time. And, if you will... On the good side of President Bush, you had a nickname, and almost every reporter had a nickname. So he really liked them. But he also viewed their relationship with him as cynical because he knew they were very cynical of him. And so he was cautious and friendly. But it was not something that he was always comfortable at doing. But he did not shy away from talking to the press. He had more press conferences than a lot of people realize. He was actually more accessible to the press than President Obama by quite a factor, actually. But it wasn't anything that he relished doing. And the relationship, they're institutionally not allowed to see themselves as friendly to any administration. And so I think they're always going to be hostile. It's the nature of the medium. And it's part of our democracy. I always thought it was a mistake to invite them into the White House rather than have them just cover the White House, because their offices are in the White House, and that means that they have access to people who can't help themselves from leaking, and that's always a problem for a chief of staff.
David?
Well, I have the perspective of having been a reporter, and so I spent a lot of my career before and in the White House explaining to clients what the job of reporters is. And it's not really to befriend the person they're covering, it's to, you know. So, you know, I'm a believer in interaction between the principal and the press. The thing that's complicated today is the thing we talked about before, because it's different than when Ronald Reagan was president. The deadline pressures, the competitive pressures, the lack of editorial judgment on some of these organizations that can drive a news cycle, even though nobody quite knows what it is or who's running it or whether it's credible or not, makes it difficult. And I will say this, every president, and we, and I think for Obama, perhaps it's been a little stinging at times because he got such a good ride for such a long time. You know, we got incredible treatment when he ran for president, and it's, you know, I think they, so that, you know, when they started behaving the way reporters do, he was taken aback, I think, a little bit. But I think everyone here would say, every president says, I don't read that stuff. And then they'll quote some, like, the third paragraph in some blog, right? Yeah. That they've. So I think one great advance in presidential press relations would be to remove the presidential iPad.
I agree with that.
Interesting question. What one piece of advice that you gave the president that he rejected that you almost resigned over?
You might have to think about that for a while.
Well, you know, I think probably the way to ask it is, did you ever feel you were close to walking out of the place?
I didn't agree with every decision the president made. I respected how he made the decisions, and I respected that they were his decisions to make. In terms of a tough decision that he made that I voiced my objection, was around stem cell research. And this was not an emergency crisis type issue. This was an issue that was presented in the context of the federal budget. No money had ever been spent on stem cell research by the federal government. The NIH and other institutions were looking to see if they could spend money on research, and it was presented as a budget question. The president said he would take under consideration. He asked me when the decision had to be made. I said it has to be made before we send the budget to Congress. So we had plenty of time. We planned the process. He brought in lots of expertise, people from the clergy, people from the medical profession, parents of children with diabetes, members of Congress, ethicists, academics, researchers, spent a lot of time doing homework. He read lots of material. There were lots of debates. He had staff people working on the issue. We met in the Oval Office, and the president was struggling because, number one, he was pro-life and didn't want to allow the collection of stem cells from embryos and aborted fetuses. And so he was very concerned. And he wrestled with the decision. He finally brought, I think there were 20 people in the Oval Office, which was unusual. And for one last debate, and everybody offered their views, he then announced that he wanted everybody's opinion. So he went person by person around the room and asked, what would you do? What would you do? What would you do? And the opinions were all over the place. And he came to me. I was literally the last person. And he said, Andy, what would you do? And I said, Mr. President, you know that I offer my counsel to you after you've heard everybody else. And we go into the back room, and I basically tell him this person was afraid to speak up because somebody else was bullying them, or I was being the honest broker. And he said, well, I want everybody to hear what you have to say. So I told him that I would support funding stem cell research. And he said, thank you very much. And then he said, okay, I'll have an answer for you tomorrow. And he walked out of the Oval Office. The next morning he came in, and I would always greet him really optimistically because I wanted him to be in a good mood. Good morning, Mr. President. Top of the morning, Mr. President.
I'm sure he's glad to see you.
Yeah. And he said, you're going to be mad at me today. You won't like what I'm doing. And I said, excuse me, Mr. President. He said, I made my decision, and you won't like it. And I said, yes, Mr. President. He said, I'm not going to fund stem cell research except for the 7 lines that have already been collected. I'm going to allow for funding of that, but I'm not going to allow for any more stem cells to be collected unless they come from adult stem cells. And he said, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I said, you didn't disappoint me. It was your decision to make. It wasn't my decision. And I respect how you made the decision. I'm comfortable with it. I tell you that as an example. I never came close to resigning over that decision, but it was one where we disagreed. There were many other times when we disagreed and would have conflict, but I can honestly not say there was one time where I felt that I was either ethically or philosophically challenged to the point that I couldn't respect that the president's decisions were his decisions and that I should be able to implement them or have others implement them to live up to his expectation.
Erskine?
You know, I've always believed that every president deserves somebody he can have a confidential conversation with. And so the president and I had many of those, and I've never written any books or not going to, because I really do think it's important for a president to have some people that he feels comfortable really working out his feelings on. And I think everybody who works for a president, you know, ought to feel that they can express their opinion. So, you know, I had many issues that the president and I didn't see quite eye to eye on, but I never came to the point on any of those where I felt I should leave, or because my job at the end of the day was to express my opinion, and if he decided it was his administration, that's what he wanted to do, then my job was to support it, and so I did.
Ken, same thing?
Absolutely the same thing as Erskine and Andy. I would only point out, even though I never came close to resigning, remember when Howard came to the White House, Howard Baker, and I came back, we did not know the truth about Iran-Contra. And so we questioned the president every which way of Sunday, up and down, trying to see whether or not he was telling the truth, that he did not know. I told this to an audience not long ago, and somebody shouted, yeah, but he was an actor. And I said, yeah, but he was a B-movie actor. You know? Yeah. We became convinced over a period of weeks that, in fact, he was telling the truth. If we had found out otherwise, it was our integrity and our duty to the country to leave. But fortunately, that never happened. And we were able to convince Reagan. All of us have had this experience. When a president makes a mistake, convincing them to do a mea culpa to the American people is like 10 root canals. I told you we all used to be 5'9", except for Erskine. Okay? And we got Reagan to do that, and the American people gave him the benefit of the doubt.
I used to be 6'7".
any moment where you...
Well, as I said earlier, you know, my job was to provide political counsel, and I was deeply, deeply frightened about entering into the health care issue, in part because of the experience that President Clinton had had and six other presidents dating back 65 years, and because of what I knew from the data and so on. I just felt it was a really, really risky political proposition, and it was a painful thing for me to give him that advice because I have a child with a chronic condition, and I've been through some of the hell that we were trying to deal with this law. So, you know, I gave him what the politics were, and I was really proud that he rejected that and said there were things more important than that. And that's why I worked for him in the first place, because I wanted to work for a president who was willing to look at the politics and say, this is more important for the country. So, you know, I never, ever, there was never a point where I said, I can't abide that decision. And almost always he made decisions that I appreciated. So, no.
We've been talking about obviously the presidents that we all served. 2016 presidential campaign. Who do you think will be the nominees for both parties? And who would you like to be the nominees of both parties? Probably a better way to say it.
I'm for Panetta.
That's what they call in the business a cheap applause button.
Yeah.
But look, I believe that if Hillary Clinton runs for president on the Democratic side, she is as overwhelming a favorite as that I've seen, in my lifetime for an open seat like this, which is probably dooms her to say that. But I really believe that she is well positioned to win the nomination. I don't see anybody emerging who would challenge her in a serious way for the nomination. And I don't know, you went to the Republicans to talk about the Republicans. That's a very hard process to handicap because, if Jeb Bush runs, I think it's one kind of race. If he doesn't run, I think it's another kind of race. It's not as obvious. Here's what I believe, though. I believe that it is unlikely that the next president will come out of the Congress. I really believe in a kind of opposites theory, which is that elections are defined by the outgoing incumbent, and never do people choose the replica of what they have. Yeah, they almost always choose the remedy. Yeah. And so, and this is not judgmental, but after Bush, people wanted someone who was more nuanced, who saw the complexities, who was, different than what they perceived they had. I think it's likely this time people are going to look for someone with more of an executive mentality, a governor. And I think, in that sense, Hillary's experience as Secretary of State is useful because it took her out of that legislative realm.
Andy?
Well, first of all, I want to say America has been a great country that we have a constitution that is an invitation. The most powerful word in the Constitution is the first word, we. It's our government, and the we is all-inclusive. And it's a noble call to serve the American people. And there is no one who personifies noble service better than Leon Panetta. And I think George Herbert Walker Bush did that. I think the presidents that we served have done that. But we're in the process of picking the next noble servant. And it will end up coming down to a binary choice. I think the most qualified person to be president is John Ellis. And most of you say, you don't know him. The truth is, he's got a great resume, and he's a great leader. But his name is John Ellis Bush, Jeb. And if he were John Ellis, I think he would be your first choice. Because he's John Ellis Bush, he, I hope, will be a binary option for you to choose between, and I'd like to see him run, and I'm encouraging him to run. That doesn't mean that he will, but he's the person, I think, who has the best resume, temperament, policy commitment, grounded in values, and would be a good president. And I'm trying not to be a Bush sycophant in saying that. There are others I would look to on the Republican side. I like going to the pool of governors that we have more than I do the pool of congressmen or congressladies or people who are serving on Capitol Hill. But I think the process is relatively wide open on the Republican side. It's not unlike what happened in 1979 and 80. And I can still remember most of these people. You will forget that they ran for president. Phil Crane, Lowell Weicker, Larry Pressler.
John Connolly.
John Connolly, Howard Baker, Bob Dole. We had Ronald Reagan, George Bush. There was a lot of people were running. And Ronald Reagan was not the favorite, but he was the front runner. And so this process will probably churn for quite a while, and a front runner will emerge that will be the nominee, and then it will be a binary choice. On the Democrat side, I remember being with Leon in, I think we were in Tennessee someplace, About this time in the calendar year.
That's about right.
And the question came up, who do you think is going to be the next president of the United States? And Leon proudly said, Hillary Clinton, 8 years ago.
That's right.
And I said, way too early to make that prediction. Oh, no, it's going to happen. And I can remember Howard Dean was going to be president and yeah. as I gave speeches around. So it's very early. We'll get there. Jeb Bush would be my choice, and I hope he runs.
We've got a few minutes here. What do you think, Erskine, quickly?
Just to comment on Jeb Bush for a second. I've done several of these events with him, particularly on education, and he's a very impressive mm-hmm. person. And I think has the kind of experience you'd want to see in a candidate for president. I'm all in for Hillary Clinton. I think she's extraordinary. What most of you all haven't seen that Leon and I have is her genuine warmth. I can remember when some of these kids in the White House were just in the toilet. And I'd be damned somehow or another she knew and she'd show up and she'd get their spirits back and they'd be ready to go. At the same time we were facing a tough decision, her judgment was terrific. So I'm for Hillary.
Ken, quickly.
Jeb, I hope he runs. And I think he'd be a hell of a president. Hillary, I think, has the Democratic nomination if she decides to run. If not, it is a free-for-all.
Can I just say one thing about Jeb Bush?
Quickly.
I'm sorry.
That's right. Go ahead.
No, I share Erskine's view. I think the great challenge for him is can he, and I think he, no, nothing tells me he wouldn't, but can he resist what the other candidates on the Republican side have yielded to in the last few cycles, which is can he maintain his positions and rather than trying to cater to the right wing of the party? If he does that, I think he'll be a very formidable candidate.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've had, I think, a fascinating discussion this evening, and we've all served different presidents who will have a different place in history, but I can tell you one thing. I think it was an honor for all of us to be able to serve the President of the United States. Thank you very much. See you next year.